You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Wisconsin Life. Then, a new report says child care providers in Milwaukee County are improving the quality of their care. We'll learn more in just a bit.
First, the Republican legislative priorities released last week include a computer or tablet for every high school freshman in Wisconsin. Our next guest says this idea is an ambitious one, but a more important priority is to make sure those students can connect to the internet.
Tom Still is with us now. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rob. Glad to be on.
Republican assembly leaders got a lot of attention for this idea, a laptop or a tablet for every incoming first-year high school student. You say that is not a bad idea, but it's getting maybe a little ahead of the game.
Oh, I think it's connected to another issue in Wisconsin, which is broadband. I think they deserve a lot of credit for recognizing that education today is increasingly about technology, and that it's especially in rural areas where access to certain types of education are going to be better facilitated by the use of technology. But what has to happen so that these tablets have a place to go is for broadband to be stronger in all parts of Wisconsin.
Yeah, talk about the state of broadband, of connectivity in a lot of rural Wisconsin.
It ranges from good to almost non-existent, depending on where you are in the state of Wisconsin. Those holes are not just because there's a lack of coverage, but a lack of coverage with adequate upload and download speeds. By that, that means how fast a computer receives and sends data. And there may be areas in Wisconsin where it's price prohibitive because there are so few people that the density required to have workable sort of plans with some of the vendors is a bit out of reach. But fortunately, there's some things on the horizon that I think can change that pretty significantly over the next 4 years.
Yeah, one of those you write about is this federal aid, the Connect America Fund. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. This is the Connect America Fund 2, and so it's sort of the second version of this overall Connect America approach. Only California among the 50 states will receive more federal dollars than Wisconsin between now and 2020. And this is a program that is really directly between the federal government, in this case the Federal Communications Commission, and providers. And so Wisconsin providers were able to show where the gaps are, the kinds of services they hope to provide, and competed quite successfully for this. And about $570 million is going to be allotted over 6 years to three providers, CenturyLink, Frontier, and AT&T. And that's kind of the pecking order of the competitive grant size, to really carry this out between now and 2020.
And Tom, this we started talking about schools. This project isn't just bringing it into school and library buildings and things like that. This is trying to get it to the whole community?
Correct. There's already been a lot of progress in Wisconsin about bringing it to libraries and schools. The problem is, again, if you have a kid with a laptop, he or she goes home to do homework. Well, if they don't have the right broadband connectivity, it doesn't happen. That tablet becomes expensive paperweight. So really what's needed is this to come into homes and come into other places and businesses into parts of rural Wisconsin that are currently underserved.
Talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, looking at efforts to expand internet access, high-speed internet access around Wisconsin, especially in rural areas. Tom, in your piece, I think you connected this or compared this to the rural electrification project of the early part of the 20th century. It's that big a deal.
Yeah, I really think that it is. I mean, rural electrification changed rural America much for the better. And then the rural telephone systems that followed in the 40s and 50s largely did much the same. I think this is on that scale. Having the right broadband connections really can help stem the loss of rural population and jobs. It can enhance e-commerce for businesses large and small. It bolster public safety. improve health through telemedicine, and boost tourism by encouraging visitors to stay longer. And I think it's also important from a demographic point of view because it can entice millennials to stay put and stay connected, which they value. And obviously, as we've already discussed, it can improve education for kids who would otherwise lose those internet connections once they leave the school grounds.
There's a long-running argument, of course, over the role of government in the economy. People are arguing, hey, the market should be relied on to do these kind of things. This, you're saying, though, is a case where the government needs to give the market a nudge.
It does, and it's not unlike other basic infrastructure needs that government now largely handles. Transportation, our roads are a good example. Parks, whatever, there are a variety of things that are not entirely going to be mainly handled in the private sector. And so this is an example where these federal dollars are going to be matched with a lot of private dollars to make some changes pretty quickly. For example, 40% of the money has to be spent by the end of 2017, and then 20% per year in each of the next 3 years. So the goal is to really bring broadband at a market price to about 230 Wisconsin homes that don't really have it today.
This is a big push. We got a lot of love from the federal government, it sounds like, in this project. When we're on the other side of it, when it's done, are we going to be where we want to be with broadband, or are there still going to be gaps and nooks and crannies that we need to take care of?
I think there will still be gaps and nooks and crannies. You're exactly right. There are some areas that maybe, so far off the road, so to speak, that, the cost of extending service to, one or two people will be difficult. Now, I think the approach that may be used a lot in Wisconsin, rather than fiber, which is quite expensive and has some other limitations, will be fixed wireless. And that will probably involve use of some existing towers that are out there, as well as some new ones. But again, will it be 100%? I really doubt that, but I think we're going to get a lot closer to where we need sometime here in the next 4 years.
Tom, very briefly, are you seeing the leadership on this from lawmakers in Wisconsin?
I think, yes. And now on the CAF, too, again, that's a federal and private initiative. It really doesn't involve the state at all. Other than the state is, I know through the state broadband coordinator is has been excited about seeing this coming down the pipe, and has worked in some specific areas to help speed facilitation, because there has to be a way to roll this out that makes sense, technically.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Tom Still with the Wisconsin Technology Council talking about broadband expansion in rural Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a new report finding recent improvements in child care in Milwaukee County.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The Pulitzer Prizes turn 100 this year. We're honoring the occasion with a look at five winners with Wisconsin ties. As a historian, it's impossible not to know the name Frederick Jackson Turner. Growing up on the West Coast, I was thrilled to move to Wisconsin and walk on Turner's ground. Perhaps no American historian stirs a more impassioned response than Frederick Jackson Turner. His ideas about the Western frontier were both admired and maligned, sparking controversy across decades. He wasn't the first American to call attention to the frontier, but he was the first to say outright that the frontier explained America. Turner was born in Portage in 1861. His father was a journalist and an amateur local historian, inspiring his son's interest in history. After earning his Ph.D. at Johns Hopkins, Turner began teaching at the University of Wisconsin in 1889. Only 4 years later, he delivered the paper that would make his name. Turner believed that American strength and vitality lay in its vast frontier. The problem for Turner was that in 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau stated that all of the land within the United States was claimed, that there was no longer a frontier. Turner delivered the news to historians during the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, where millions had flocked to see such wonders as a reproduction Egyptian temple and new inventions like the Ferris wheel, the electric dishwasher, and the zipper. For Turner, the fair was also the end of an era. Turner's lecture, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, mournfully proclaimed the frontier closed. He questioned how American culture would develop and whether something of the American character, its coarseness, individualism, and strength, would be lost as a result. His paper was both an analysis of the past and a warning for the future. Turner's lecture was mostly ignored at the time, but it soon became one of the most influential pieces of historical writing in American history. It also shaped popular conceptions of the West and the types of people who lived there. The frontier wasn't Turner's only explanation for the uniqueness of America. He also attributed it to sectionalism, or groups of states with similar resources that were often at odds with each other. He actually argued that these sections were more important than states in shaping American history. It was this idea, which he put into a book called The Significance of Sections in American History, that won him a Pulitzer Prize in 1933. Turner didn't live to see his award, though. He died in 1932. That he won an award for a book was surprising in a way because Turner didn't actually write that much. Besides his hobbies and his family, he devoted most of his energy to teaching. He was adored by his students for his intellect, encouragement, kindness, and enthusiasm. Turner still matters. In my college and grad school history classes, I couldn't escape Turner. Agree with him or not, his ideas laid the foundation for the modern study of the American West. And to have your ideas discussed more than a century after sharing them? No mean feat. As Turner said, history, both objective and subjective, is ever becoming, never completed. The centuries unfold to us more and more the meaning of past times. Turner offered us one story, one meaning. He pointed us toward an understanding of ourselves as a nation, a mythic West of noble cowboys, open spaces, an adventure that still informs our conceptions of ourselves as Americans today. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, in 2010, Wisconsin established a new set of parameters and benchmarks for child care providers in the state called the Young Star Program.
And according to a new report, since the program's establishment, child care providers have gotten better in the state's most populous area, Milwaukee County.
Joining us to talk about how child care is improving in Milwaukee County is Joe Pietrangelo. He's a senior researcher at the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee and the co-author of that report. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So the findings from the Young Star program are in. This is after 5 years of the program in effect. Give us the umbrella view. What changes did you see?
So first of all, we only looked at the Milwaukee County providers and children, but the general view is positive that we see progress being made in improving the quality of child care in Milwaukee County. There's been a shift from most providers or a majority of providers and a majority of children being in care that was maybe just meeting basic expectations to being more at the proficient level. So we've seen a shift from the 2-star level to the 3-star level on a 5-star scale.
So overall news is good, and we're going to dive into a few of the specifics in just a bit. But first, tell us what the Young Star program is.
The Young Star program was created in 2010. The purpose of the program is to rate the quality of child care providers in the state and to incentivize improvement and assist with improvement of quality over time. Part of the rationale for creating it also was to remove fraud that had been discovered in the Wisconsin Share system. So there were a variety of goals that went into it, but essentially the program rates providers and modifies the amount of Wisconsin Share's subsidies that providers can receive for serving low-income families based on the quality of the care that they're providing.
So you mentioned a couple of the things you were hoping to improve. In general, what were you looking to move, to change as you went forward with the Young Star program?
Well, the goal really is to get more of the providers up to higher STAR levels and more of the children being served by the program into those providers as well. So some of the program evaluates the providers in four categories. One of them is the education of the staff who work in the child care center, or in some cases it's a home-based child care provider. But the education of the provider is one key aspect. Another is the learning environment and the curriculum. So that's another evaluation category. Health and safety. So there are several areas that the providers are rated on, and they have to meet different different qualifications or requirements in order to advance to a higher rating. So so what we've seen is improvements in all of those areas. There's still challenges over time, and we can discuss those as well, but overall there's been an improvement in those areas that's allowed more providers to shift up to at least a 3-star level.
So you've mentioned this starred rating system that you have from 1 to 5. Just briefly, can you walk us through the difference between a 1 and a 5?
Well, so a 1-star provider is deemed not to be meeting basic health and safety standards, so they're removed from the Wisconsin share system, so they cannot receive state subsidies anymore. A 2-star provider is, as I mentioned, is meeting sort of the basic health and safety standards, so they're at least able to qualify for subsidies, but there's no on-site kind of evaluation system that goes into it. It's just sort of meeting those basic requirements. To earn a 3, 4, or 5-star rating, you have to go through evaluation and that looks at those four kind of categories that I mentioned, and requires you to, for example, with staff education, you need to have your staff at higher and higher levels of credentials, either basically credits that are directly related to childcare. And as you go up the rating scale, more of your staff need to have higher numbers of credits, if not degrees. So that's an example of sort of how the rating scale works and how you need to advance in all of those areas to improve your rating.
We're talking with Joe Pietrangelo right now. He is senior researcher at the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee, and we're talking about the state of child care in Milwaukee County. And Joe, let's get to the key findings over the past 5 years with this Young Star program in place. Now, you mentioned the majority of children receiving these Wisconsin share subsidies in the county are now enrolled at 3-star providers. How big a change is that?
Well, it's a pretty big change. We first looked at the ratings back in 2012, and 54% of the student or of the children were in 2-star providers, and now we're looking at in 2016 it was up to 54% being in 3-star providers. So there was a pretty significant shift over those four years. We also have seen an increase in the number of providers who are in the 4 and 5-star, so the highest quality providers. And so in terms of the number of children served or the percentage, that's increased from 9% to 19%. So that's been a big increase as well. But we also see that in Milwaukee County, we're still behind the rest of the state in terms of the quality of child care. We're 28% of the children statewide that are receiving Wisconsin shares are in those 4 and 5-star providers. So we still have work to do.
And another area of work to do is in the home-based family child care situations. What's different there?
Yeah, we saw a major difference between group child care centers that you would think of as a larger center versus a home-based provider. There are different rating systems or there are different rating tracks in Young Star for those different types of providers. And the family providers, we found a majority are actually at the 2-star level, 62%. So that was really distinct from the other tracks. And the other thing is we had seen a decrease over the past 3 years of 22% in the number of family providers operating or receiving Wisconsin shares in Milwaukee County, so a significant decline, whereas the other tracks, YoungStar has not only the group center track, but there's tracks for after-school programs as well, and those tracks have seen increases in the number of providers as well as increases in their ratings. So we're seeing unique challenges with those home-based providers that's actually resulted in fewer of them being available, and their reimbursements are also lower, because if you're a two-star provider, the state reduces the amount that you're reimbursed by 5%. So there's a little bit of a cut for having a lower rating.
And Joe, just briefly as we wrap up, what are the goals going forward for the next 5 years of YoungStar?
That is a good question. I mean, I think continuing to improve increase the percentage of kids that are in high quality care is always the underlying goal of the program. So that will continue to be the case. I think there's been a major focus over the past several years on moving providers from a two-star to three-star, so just getting them up to the proficient levels. Now we're going to, I think, see more of a push to go from there up to having a higher having more providers in those highest quality ratings of 4 and 5 stars. It's a lot of work to get there, to get staff trained to those levels and other meeting other requirements as well. But I think that's where the push is going to be in Milwaukee County.
Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher at the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a report he co-authored that found that child care is improving in Milwaukee County.
Coming up, a philosopher who's also a game designer says playing games can help us be more resilient, focused, and happy. We'll find out how to apply the rules of gaming to our daily lives. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it is Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's stories from people who pushed it to the limit. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, many of us think of play as something we get to do after the lawn is mowed and the dishes are done and the hundreds of emails finally get answered.
Whether we're playing on a sports field in our backyard or over a board game, we tend to think of play as an escape from our mundane daily life, which, let's face it, can get kind of boring some of the time.
Our next guest is a game designer and philosopher, and he asks what would happen if we approached life the same way we approached games. By looking more closely at the true nature of games and applying those concepts to the daily slog, he believes we can overcome boredom and anxiety and live a more focused and meaningful life.
Ian Bogost is with us now. He's a philosopher, game designer, and professor of interactive computing, at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His new book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we hear sometimes about gamifying our lives, trying to take principles from games, keeping score of the things we do, that kind of thing. That's not what you're talking about, though. How are you trying to draw lessons from the world of games and play and translate them into our everyday lives?
Yeah, many people think that the unique properties of games are these ideas like points or levels. And for me, it's limitations, constraints, rules, if you want. You know, we sometimes think about the rules of a game as the things that you read and then they guide the way that you play. And when you enter the soccer pitch, you agree to subscribe to the rules of soccer. When you play Tetris or a computer game, you kind of can't help but agree to play by the rules of the computer game. So if we take that idea of the material limitations and constraints and structure of whatever it is that we're dealing with, and then look for those limitations and constraints everywhere, then we can use that idea as a way of kind of bringing this playful way of thinking to just about anything we encounter.
Can you connect the dots for me? Why is it fun to live within a set of rules? Most of life is comprised of rules. What makes that fun?
Right. We think that we hate constraint or that we hate structure, that we're always trying to escape from it. If only I could go do the thing I really wanted to, you know, and you go to work and you want to go home, and then you get home and you have chores to do, and you wait for the weekend, and then the weekend comes along and you have to mow the lawn. So in some ways, that desire for escape, that sense that real meaning is always somewhere else, it is doomed. It's hopeless. And it also assumes that there's only pleasure to be found in remarkable experiences, you know, vacations or Christmas time or birthdays or marriage or what have you. But we experience all of those repetitive things, you know, commuting to work and dealing with your email and doing the dishes and putting the kids to bed. And so it's not so much that we need to forget about the meaningful, momentous occasions, but if we can also find meaning and power in those smaller scale experiences, then wouldn't that make for a better, bigger life? But you also brought up this word fun, which is one that I address substantially in the book, and I kind of have my own, you know, my own sense of what fun means. It's one of those words that when you hear people say it, did you have fun? Oh, we had a fun time. They usually don't know what they mean at all. If you stop yourself next time you say fun and say, what am I really trying to say? It's not just pleasure exactly. It's not that, you know, I enjoyed myself precisely, because often the things that we describe as fun are kind of miserable. They involve a lot of work. You know, a fun game of soccer or even a fun outing can involve physical exertion, or it can involve, working through problems with friends at the pub. So for me, fun is this discovery of novelty. And if we can find something new in anything, in any situation, even the ones that feel suffocating, by just finding their structure and seeing what we can do if we work with that material a little more directly, a little more closely, then we can, we can have fun at everything.
Well, I'm a big nerd when it comes to games, board games, computer games, things like that. And I can see the sense of fun there, where in this constrained situation, I'm overcoming challenges, getting something at the end, whether I win or lose. I can see the fun in that. How do I now take that into a tedious activity, commuting, shopping at the store, something that I might not usually think of as being fun, and translate that mindset to where it is in some way fun?
Yeah, if you think of play rather than the opposite of work, you think of it as the play in a thing, like the play in a mechanism. You know, sometimes we talk about there being some play in a steering rack in a vehicle before the steering engages. Then that can be a guide. If you look at a situation or an object or a person or a scenario, you say, okay, well, you know, what's going on here? What are the structures? What are the materials that I can manipulate and use? And how might I address them and make change within them? So think about playing a guitar. When you play a guitar, you don't try to escape the fretboard and the strings and the body of it. You engage with it, right? You strum the guitar and you hold your fingers in certain patterns, and that's what playing it means. Doing something like throwing it across the room, I mean, that might be a different kind of activity, but it doesn't count as playing the guitar. So once you get accustomed to looking at the deep structure of circumstances and situations, then it's actually quite easy. What is commuting made of? Well, it's made of a set of decisions in your vehicle or on foot or in the train about which route you're going to take and when you're going to leave and which turn you're going to take here. And as you develop a series of variations, maybe on your usual routine that perhaps are chosen to find a faster route or a more scenic one, or one that you don't go by every day, or one that takes you to an errand that you have to run that day anyway. Then, you know, it's not so much that that's a game. It would be kind of ridiculous to call it a game, but rather you're playing the commuting experience, or the experience that is game-like is made out of commuting. Commuting becomes the materials by which you play. I think it takes quite a bit of doing to stop oneself and say, okay, you know, it's not so much that I want to play a game with my commute, but rather I want to look very deeply and closely at the structure and materials and limitations and constraints that are posed by that circumstance. And then once you do, much to your delight and surprise, there's always something else you can do with it, always something new. Oh, I can load the dishwasher in this slightly different way. Or, oh, I see that, you know, doing it that way, I didn't clean the glasses on top very well, so I'm going to try something else next time. And this plays out over, you know, many, many iterations of even very ordinary, very mundane tasks. It's just that we don't find ourselves as adults so accustomed to looking at things in that way. We often lose that capacity as we grow older.
We're talking right now with Ian Bogost. He is a game designer and a philosopher, professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, author of the book Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secrets of Games. And we're talking about how to bring play into all areas of our life. And Ian, you start your book taking on the commencement speech of the writer David Foster Wallace, and he's talking about some of this boring stuff about life that you were alluding to, kind of going to the grocery store and wrestling with long lines and carrying your bags, and how it's kind of soul-sucking. And at the end of that essay, he says we should sort of be more empathic toward the people around us and realize that they may have tough lives too, and that's sort of how you get through that repetition and boredom of daily life. And you take issue with that. You kind of say, no, that's not any kind of way to engage with life. What do you see as being wrong with his argument?
The problem with Wallace's argument is that it puts this enormous burden on the self to come up with those alternatives. You know, so the problem that he's cueing into is that we live in this secular age. We don't look to God or to other sorts of theological or social structures to tell us the moral or the correct thing to do. It all has to come from within. And so while I think Wallace is right to ask people to stop, you know, you're always tempted to look past things, say, oh, there can't possibly be anything worthwhile in this, you know, this miserable shopping experience where I'm waiting in line behind slow people who are, you know, getting checks cleared or something. That act of stopping and saying, no, wait, there's something more here, that part's right. But the part that's too burdensome is a feeling is that we have to invent these stories about other things or other people in order to tolerate those circumstances. Because when you think about it, it's kind of like a rat race for worst case scenarios. You know, what is the most empathic possible scenario I can paint of the woman in line at the grocery store who's holding up the works, and you know, maybe she's a cancer survivor, or maybe there's a terrible thing going on at home, or maybe she had a much worse day than I do. You know, where does that end? It's much better to treat the situation for what you can prove about it, what you know about it. And, you know, it seems ridiculous to talk about having fun in line at the grocery store, but we also do it all the time. We look around. Maybe we do some email on our phone, or maybe we look at a magazine that's sitting by the rack, or review the materials in the cart, or even find ourselves aware of the temptation to purchase those items that sit at the checkout. All of those kinds of experiences, in them we're working with the world that's presented before us. Whereas, you know, inventing these stories about other people in the world, we're always doomed to think, well, you know, things could be worse. I'm still miserable because, you know, my life is still better than someone else's.
Hey, Ian, I understand your road to thinking in this way started in Milwaukee. Your father had a traffic accident that ultimately led him to have severely impaired vision. Can you talk about a little bit about your family experience and how it led to this?
That's right. I have an unusual surname, Bogost, and in fact, it was a kind of Ellis Island perversion of a much longer Russian name, and all of the Bogosts worldwide can trace their stories back to Wisconsin, where my grandfather's family settled when they came to the U.S. in the early 20th century, and my dad when he was 18. In the 50s, got in this terrible car accident and was thrown from the vehicle through the windshield and suffered. Was in a coma for a month or so. And once he came to, you know, they'd had to perform surgery. And one of the lasting effects of this that he still faces, 80 years old now, is a near blindness, you know, legal blindness. He's always been visually impaired. So the whole, you know, for my whole life, being with my dad, you know, has been a process of identifying and paying close attention to all of the ordinary things that surround us. You know, there's a step here. Don't trip over this sort of imperfection in the curb. Here's the aspirin you're looking for on the white counter that you can't quite see. Or, you know, here's a technique to know where the radio dial is. And so, in a lot of ways, this was terrifically annoying as a kid, right? Or even as an adult, you know, all of the litanies of menu items read aloud at every meal, and the nuisance of having to deal with disability in a family, which, you know, we tend not to talk about because it's very difficult to contend with. But also the way that focused all of our attention, you know, my attention, my mom's attention, my dad's attention, and those around us, for better or worse, on the ordinary things around us, you know. And I have all of these memories of that ordinariness, being at a motel and going to get ice down the hall and looking for, you know, helping my dad find the button, the sort of lighter brown button in the darker brown bezel around it. And you know, the way that kind of attention forces you to think about something like the design of ice machine buttons or the difference in color between them. And it may seem unimportant or, you know, a kind of luxury in some way to have the ability to think about that sort of attention rather than to have to suffer through the experience of living it. But to me, it trained me in some way. It gave me a kind of physical education in paying heed to ordinary objects and ordinary things, which is really the subject of the book and the summary of the idea. You know, if you can take pleasure in your toaster and the motel ice machine, then what could you not take pleasure in?
We're talking about how we can bring play into all areas of our lives to add focus and meaning. We're talking with philosopher and game designer Ian Bogost. He's professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He's the author of the new book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you found games and sports helpful in other areas of your life? Maybe you play sports or board games. You agree that the way in which we approach play can enhance those other areas of our lives. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation about play and how we can bring play into other areas of our lives, especially those that can seem like drudgery.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an ability? Are you able to bring play and fun into the boring stuff, the daily routine? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ian Bogost stays with us. He's a philosopher, a game designer, and professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His latest book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
And we'll go right to our callers. We've got Luke on the line in Green Bay. Luke, hi.
Hey there. I was just curious, Ian, having a background in philosophy, when you say the pleasure of limits, it sounds a lot like the old Stoic philosophy, and I was curious if you considered your theory of living your life as if you're playing a series of games fits into that philosophy, sort of like Marcus Aurelius and some of those classics.
Luke, thanks for the call. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a savvy question. The Stoics do make an appearance in the book, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is this kind of alternative to looking to happiness or mindfulness, these selfish goals as a way of guiding oneself, and instead to see the sort of Stoic defamiliarization of objects around us and our preparation for the world to continue kind of without us, right, as a way of being able not just to tolerate but to find new meaning. There's this very famous Stoic aphorism or story from Epictetus that, you know, when you put your children to bed, you should imagine in this kind of morbid way, well, what if you die tonight? You know, what would I do next? And it seems very strange, but what it points to is this idea of kind of thinking about the full range of possibilities of a relationship or a circumstance, and using that as a way of structuring our relationship to it, of responding to that set of possibilities. So yeah, I mean, I certainly think that the anything that pushes our attention outside of us, right, is a useful compass bearing.
And Ian, we got a lot of callers waiting to talk to you, but I just want to follow up really quickly. You equated mindfulness with selfishness just a moment ago, and that's being billed pretty heavily right now as a path toward happiness and ease in our lives. What do you think about that?
Right. I mean, the mindfulness trend to me, you know, has some utility, but where it fails is in helping us deal with the surplus of materials that are in our world, right? You know, when you borrow Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, Zen, and so forth, it feels good to sort of think that we can separate and use mindfulness to kind of stop ourselves and address our feelings and thoughts and then readdress the world. But we live in this you know, hyper-consumerist society. We have all these different choices of ketchups and shampoos at the store and all of the cars on the road. And there's something kind of fundamentally more incompatible about the world that we live in or online, you know, all of this stuff on your phone or in your inbox, and the attitude of Eastern mindfulness. So instead, if you flip that on its head, and I have this concept of worldfulness as kind of the opposite of mindfulness, and use that same exercise that Eastern thinking provides, where you stop yourself and then look more closely. But what you look more closely at is not inside yourself, but outside it. What is the world telling me? What is here, and what can I do with it?
Let's go back to our callers. Laurel is on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Laurel, hi.
Hi. I love what your guest has to say, because I, especially what he's just saying now about the surplus of information and things that can seem overwhelming. And I think we can almost think of like a mental closet and just think, I'm going to deal with that someday. And you put things that seem overwhelming in this closet, and it just feels like you're getting buried. And lately, and I'm not sure why, but I've just kind of done what he's saying about taking something and turning it into a game and thinking, I'm just going to take the 5 minutes and master this, instead of thinking, oh, someday I'll learn how to boost a Facebook page, or someday I'll learn how to make Creme Fraiche. And just doing it in the moment, and it feels so empowering.
Laurel,
so I guess.
Thank you so much. So, Ian, she's taking an infinite realm of possibilities of things she can do, setting some constraints and picking one of them and engaging with that, it sounds like.
Right. And one of the weird things about constraints and limits or rules in games is that counterintuitively, the more of them that you add, the easier it is to act. You know, if you took something like soccer as an example that everybody knows, you say, okay, you can do what you want on a field, then it's hard to know what to choose. But if you throw a ball in the field, you say, okay, maybe I'll move the ball around. Oh, and you can only use your feet and your torso. Okay. And you've got to get it into a net. You know, then your action is focused. You have a better sense of not just what you can do, but what you are going to choose to do given the constraints that you've adopted. And you can do that with ordinary things too. You know, what is creme fraiche anyway, and what goes into it, and what's the process of making it? What are the techniques and the traditions and so forth? Once you add all those limitations in, you find yourself in a position where you can act. And, you know, the next day you might choose to do something else. But for that moment in that scenario, you're focused on a specific thing and at one with it, you know, communing with it directly.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laurel. And Ian, as we wrap up, I assume you're practicing the things that you're talking about, that you've sort of integrated them into your own life. How does the shape of your life look or feel different now?
Yeah, I mean, this is a struggle for me, like it is for anyone. Writers, I think, write about what they struggle with, and this has always been a struggle for me. But the opportunities are so endless that I find myself able to stop myself from getting anxious or getting angry or upset. And just asking, okay, well, you know, what's happening here? One example that I can give you is that a little while back, my wife was carrying a gallon of milk up the stairs, and she kind of tripped, and in this freak accident, the jug of milk split, and the milk just poured down the stairs, just cascaded down the down the stairs. And I was actually finishing some writing at the time. I was very stressed out, and you know, here's this thing going on now that we have to clean up. And as ridiculous as it sounds, when I stop myself, I say, okay, well, you know, this is probably the only time I'm going to see this much milk in my life. Let's just look at what that much milk looks like and how it sounds as this kind of improvised art installation pouring down my stairs. That was delightful. That was delightful enough that it got me out of the mode of anxiety that I was tempted to move into. And then, of course, we cleaned it up and got on with our lives. And I hope that never, ever happens again.
And that's a great image to leave it with. Thanks to Ian Bogost. His new book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.